Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Fulilove, and it's my pleasure to be welcoming you here today to our first event of 2016. I hope you're enjoying the lunch and the wine a little bit more upmarket than usual to mark our first event here at our beautiful new headquarters at 1 Bligh Street. This building is a little different from our old home, and I should admit my bias as an historian and someone who was present at the creation of the Lowy Institute. I'm very partial to 31 Bligh Street. I remember when Mr. Lowy, our chairman, first inspected the building at 31 Bligh Street. We hosted everybody from Aung San Suu Kyi to Rupert Murdoch and everybody in between in the old building. White papers were launched, presidents visited. We hosted the last half dozen Australian prime ministers in that building. Of course, that statistic is less impressive these days than it once was. So the building is very much a part of our history, and it's also a part of our future. You probably know some of the backstory, but we've had to move out of the building for a number of years while there's a major construction site next door. And when the construction is finished, we will, and as soon as we're able to, we'll move back to 31 Bligh. But in the meantime, we're delighted to be here in these new headquarters. We've gone, it turns out, from 31 Bligh Street to level 3, 1 Bligh Street, which I'm taking as a good omen. This is a beautiful building, of course. It's one of the most beautiful and prestigious skyscrapers in town. It has 6-star environmental credentials. And it's also the houses the Commonwealth parliamentary offices. So the Prime Minister, the federal ministers, the senators have offices here in this building. So for an institute that is focused very much on international issues, that's a nice coincidence. It also means that the cafe downstairs is not a place you want to go if you want to have a private meeting. So keep an eye out on that. If any of you are interested in celebrity spotting in Australian politics, Janus downstairs is the place to be. Ladies and gentlemen, last year was a red letter year for the Institute, perhaps the most successful in our history. But here at the Institute, we are always looking ahead, and 2016 will be another great year. Later this month, we will launch our newest Lowy Institute paper. You'll recall these Lowy Institute papers are co-published with Penguin, available in bookstores around the country. And the latest one, The Embarrassed Colonialist, is written by the veteran PNG correspondent or Pacific correspondent Sean Dorney on Australia's approach to Papua New Guinea. We're about to launch a number of new products and papers, including a global diplomatic index, and we hope very shortly to announce the details of the 2016 Lowy lecture. So watch this space. Ladies and gentlemen, moving outside from the Lowy Institute to the world, 2015 was a big year in international affairs. Agreement was reached with Iran to curb Tehran's nuclear ambitions, at least for a decade or so. Countries like Australia continued their action in the Middle East to disrupt international terrorism. And closer to home, tensions became more acute in China's near seas. We had Peter Greste's release from a jail in Cairo. We had the attacks, the Charlie Hebdo offices, and later the other attacks in Paris. Elections in Myanmar, which saw our old friend Aung San Suu Kyi on the cusp of assuming power, if not office, in Myanmar. We had a number of international disasters, and of course we had the historic climate change agreement that was reached in Paris. And already 2016 is shaping up to be another busy year with a number of elections, including here in Australia, in the United States, around the Pacific and in other parts of the world. Today's session is about drawing out three brilliant Lowy Institute experts on the big issues that will impact on Australia and the world in 2016. Let me get down to it and introduce my colleagues and invite them to join me on the stage as I introduce them. First of all, Anthony Bubalo. Anthony is the Deputy Director here at the Institute, where he coordinates the Institute's research output. His own research focuses on Australian policy towards the Middle East and linkages between East Asia and West Asia. He has written widely on Islamism, democratisation and Middle Eastern politics, with a particular focus on Egypt, Israel and the Gulf states. Jenny Hayward-Jones is the director of our Melanesia program. She is one of Australia's preeminent experts on Australian policy in the Pacific Islands region, political and social change in Melanesia, and the strategic and economic challenges facing Pacific Islands in the Asian century. Before joining the Institute, Jenny spent 13 years as an Australian Foreign Service officer with DFAT, including serving in missions in Vanuatu in Turkey, where I first met Jenny, and the Regional Assistance Mission in the Solomon Islands. And finally, Dr. Ewan Graham is the director of our International Security Program. Ewan has been a close observer of East Asian security affairs for more than 20 years in academia, the private sector, and for the British government. Ewan joined the Institute in 2015 from the Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore, where he was a senior fellow specialising in maritime issues. He is genuinely one of the world's experts on maritime security issues, especially in our part of the world. So we've lured him to Sydney at a great time in the geopolitical cycle. Prior to Singapore, Ewan was a research analyst at the British Foreign Office and served as chargé d'affaires at the British Embassy in Pyongyang. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Anthony, Jenny and Ewan. To begin with, I'm going to ask each of my colleagues in no more than 4 or 5 minutes to tell us about the big three issues that we should keep an eye on in 2016 in their part of the world. And Anthony, I might start with you. What should we be focused on in the Middle East?
At the moment, given what's been happening in the Middle East, it's difficult to decide what to focus on. There's so much. You can focus on literally anything in the region, given the tumult there. But I think there are three things in particular that we need to keep an eye on. The first, most obviously, is what happens with Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. It's become a bit of a kind of truism that our efforts to defeat Islamic State, and by our I mean the kind of US-led coalition's efforts to defeat Islamic State, are faltering a bit, that for all the kind of very gradual progress we're making on the ground, the movement survives. I think that's now starting to be re-evaluated, or deserves to be re-evaluated a bit. We saw in the second half of last year Islamic State suffer some significant military setbacks, and I think that trend will continue this year, particularly as the very incremental and very gradual military effort that was launched 18 months ago to combat Islamic State builds up a little bit of momentum. So I think we'll see that. Now, one of the consequences of that will be, unfortunately, that I think we will see more terrorist attacks outside of Iraq and Syria, either led by Islamic State or undertaken by Islamic State sympathisers. There's been a very clear pattern where when Islamic State suffers reversals on the battlefield, it reacts by promoting or launching terrorist attacks outside. In part to demonstrate to its supporters that it still has, that it's still around, it's still surviving, and that it still has momentum. So that's one thing to watch out for. The second thing, of course, will be to see the way that the Iranian nuclear deal that was struck last year between Iran and members of the international community led by the US, how that plays out, both in terms of the outside world's relations with Iran, but also domestically within Iran. There's some really interesting straws in the wind. Now, domestically within Iran, President Rouhani's government and President Rouhani and his foreign minister Zarif were key figures in not just in negotiating the deal with the outside world, but in convincing the more conservative, more hardline parts of the regime, most notably Supreme Leader Khamenei, to actually do this deal with the West. They will hope now that they can reap some of the benefits politically. And so one of the battles that we'll see over the next kind of 12 months is the effort of Rouhani and his more centrist, more pragmatic elements within the regime, their efforts to try and reap the political benefits. The first test of that will be in the forthcoming elections for Iran's parliament, the Majlis, but also for the Assembly of Experts. And already we've seen conservative forces try to curtail those benefits by disqualifying large numbers of centrist or moderate candidates for those elections. So internally, that will be one thing to watch. Externally, it will also be something to watch because the there remains a great deal of nervousness in the region about the deal and what it does to Iran. We'll continue to see, I think, an escalation in the Saudi-Iranian rivalry. I don't think the Iranians, the regime is likely to cheat on the deal and through that cause some problems in its implementation, at least not in the first year. But I think there will be other elements of Iran's behaviour, most notably the development of its ballistic missile program, that will put some pressure on the kind of the slightly better relationship that the deal has created between Iran and the United States and some Western countries. The third and final thing to watch will be what I call the crumbling of the authoritarian return. Now, what I mean by that is, after the Arab uprisings in 2011, where you did see a number of long-term regimes overthrown, you saw not long after that, in a year or two after that, an authoritarian return where authoritarian states that were struggling against these uprisings were able to consolidate power, or even in places like Egypt, where there had been an overthrow of power, you've seen a return back to authoritarianism. I think in the next year, particularly as a result of economic pressures, that authoritarian return will also face some difficulties and face some problems, and I think we'll see that in Egypt, where Egypt recently celebrated the fifth anniversary of the January Revolution that overthrew the Mubarak regime. There were no protests on the ground, leading to the sense that that the regime is consolidating. I think the regime will continue to struggle. Will now start to struggle to keep protests, to keep internal disruption tamped down, largely because they aren't able to address some of the economic concerns that drove the uprising in the first place, exacerbated in particular by what's likely to be a prolonged low price for oil. So they're my three picks for the year.
Terrific. Jenny, what about the Pacific, closer to home for us?
Thanks, Michael. I'm going to focus on three countries that I think are facing some pretty difficult challenges in the year ahead. Papua New Guinea, our nearest neighbour, is facing very significant economic crisis this year, following a budget crisis that emerged late last year, caused in part by a dramatic fall in commodity prices. We're seeing Papua New Guinea deal now with a devastating drought and deal with it not very well, so they'll be under pressure to step up that response. Literally, people are starving to death in the Western Province and in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, so the pressure on the government to improve its response and get more food out to the population is going to be the first order of priority for the year. Raising a sovereign bond is an approach the PNG government has talked about in order to resolve some of its economic challenges, but it's going to be a difficult market for them going forward. It's going to be significant constraint on their budget expenditure and delivery of essential services like health and education, at a time when they're supposed to be doubling down on their intention to continue on with a free education and free health policy. So pretty difficult time for Papua New Guinea. Of course, we're seeing preparations for elections in 2017 and inadequate funding at the moment going to the Electoral Commission to prepare for those very important elections. PNG is due to host APEC in 2018 and has a very difficult road ahead in making sure that it funds and builds the necessary infrastructure for that and is adequately prepared, so big year ahead and a difficult one. In Fiji, where what I like to call the Rebuilding Democracy Project is not going so well. So after the euphoria of elections in September 2014, we thought everything would be back to normal following 8 years of a coup regime. We're starting to see some cracks. Importantly, the expat police commissioner, who'd been implementing a lot of reforms in the Fiji police last year, was sacked late in the year, replaced by a colonel from the military, who now looks likely to take the job permanently, thus blurring the division between police and the military in Fiji, which is really not good for anyone, and showing Fiji military is still incredibly powerful, despite the fact that we have return to democracy. In some other worrying signs, the opposition National Federation Party was yesterday suspended for a short period over a technicality. Strangely, coincidentally or not, this was 2 days after its leader published a damning editorial in the Fiji Times, critical of the state of democracy in Fiji. So a few things that worry me there. On the positive side, there is a parliament, there are functioning courts, it is possible to publish damning editorials in the press, so there are some good things happening. The economy in Fiji also doing fairly well at the moment. In Vanuatu, a place very dear to my heart, we've just had elections. There's now a 21-day period where a coalition needs to be formed. Results were issued just yesterday. Unfortunately, we're seeing a very divided parliament yet again. The elections were held quickly last month after 14 members of parliament were effectively disbarred, I guess, suspended from standing for election and chucked out of parliament because they had been found guilty of bribery charges. So we're all quite hopeful this would lead to a new parliament with new MPs very committed to integrity and opposed to corruption. But the makeup of the parliament, with 17 parties, many of them tiny, three of the major parties are only winning 6 seats each in 52-member parliament, doesn't augur well for a stable coalition. In fact, I think it's going to be the most diabolical coalition management task going forward that Vanuatu has ever had. Vanuatu is the only country in the region to have more prime ministers than Australia in the last decade. So we really need Vanuatu to keep going on the stability path just to make sure we look good. Vanuatu is also facing very significant economic challenges in recovering from the devastating cyclone Pam, which hit last year, the worst ever cyclone to hit the Pacific, and unfortunately has just suffered from a deterioration in its airport in Port Vila, causing major airlines to pull out, and no doubt a significant drop in tourism revenue will be ahead. So fixing the condition of that airport will be the priority for the new government.
Terrific. Thank you. Ewan, what about Asia and security issues?
Thank you, Michael. Well, two of my areas I think will be of no surprise. I'm going to talk a little bit about the South China Sea and North Korea. But if there is a surprise for an international security director, my first area is actually Australia. Why? Because this is an important year for defence in particular. Two key areas. One, the defence white paper, which was delayed from last year, will certainly be released at some point this year. We don't know when, but it's certain to happen at some point in 2016. I think the delay itself is no surprise, obviously, given the shift in leadership last year. And perhaps not too serious a thing either. Defence white papers, we often forget, are actually supposed to be at 5-yearly intervals. That's not been the case recently, only 2013 since the last iteration. Defence white papers are all supposed to do 3 core things. One is to set the strategic environment, frame that honestly, to set the requirement for the desired defence capability, and thirdly, to provide the required level of funding. It's that third area that the recent defence white papers have slipped up on. They've been long on ambition, but short on cash commitments. What's supposed to be the key difference with this defence white paper is it's supposed to be the first fully funded, costed defence white paper. So that's obviously key to watch. It's also, I think, key to watch in terms of if there is a difference in policy between Mr. Abbott and Mr. Turnbull. I think we've already seen, in terms of the broad strategic judgments, it's unlikely to shift greatly. But where there may be an element of doubt is whether Mr. Turnbull is as committed as his predecessor to increasing defence spending on that pathway up to 2% of GDP. So that's something we'll certainly look for a key indicator from when the defence white paper does come out. Secondly, in the defence realm, and connected, but not directly with the white paper, we also face the significant procurement decision on the future submarine this year, also delayed from last year. Germany, France, Japan all remain in contention for that deal, which will be the largest, not just in defence history in Australia, but one of the largest ever public projects. The estimates are put in a very loose ballpark from $30 to $50 billion. The point is we don't know. It's going to be a great deal, a great sum of money involved. Also very challenging in terms of the technologies and the politics involved, to the extent this is not just an off-the-shelf defence deal, it's likely to be potentially some form of strategic alignment between the two countries because of the depth of that cooperation required, and all eyes in particular, I think, on Japan, which remains the favourite but still not over the line yet by any stretch. And then thirdly, in the defence realm, this is a sort of segue to my second area, the question of whether Australia will launch its own freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea has bubbled up slowly over the last year, but really in the last month it's become at the front and centre of Australian politics. We've seen the opposition defence spokesman actually weighing in on this with an opinion editorial to try and put pressure on Mr Turnbull to, if you like, put his money where his mouth is and not just give diplomatic support to the United States, but to put Australian ships and potentially aircraft in the South China Sea to make that point directly. It's still, again, rather like the submarine decision, perhaps an odds-on likelihood that it will happen, but we're not there yet, and I think it's still at that point where a key development could actually potentially derail the government's commitment to that. Personally, I think it's something that should happen, and I welcome your views and your questions on that in the question and answer session of the session today. The South China Sea, I think the core question that overhangs that issue of whether Australia should be involved is whether in 2016 China will lock up the gains that it already has done a lot of front loading to do, particularly in the form of artificial islands that it has constructed in the last 2 years. And there the key question is whether that infrastructure that goes in on those seven islands that China has poured a lot of concrete on, whether that'll be military in nature. If it is military in nature, and I think it will be to some degree, the Chinese have already said so in effect, but how far are they willing to push that spectrum? I think there are two key external limits that frame that. One is the United States presidential cycle, because we're in the final year of a second term, in which perhaps the Obama administration is more likely than not just to be holding the line. The big unknown is what will happen next, and perhaps that's something that encourages China to actually push now and lock in those gains while the political mood and the strategic environment with an outgoing US president is likely to be more favorable than it will be next year. But there's an even shorter term impetus to that, which is the Philippines has a legal case which is pending in The Hague. We're expecting a decision halfway through the year. We've also got elections, presidential elections in the Philippines due in May. And that will also be an interesting bilateral variable. We're used to thinking of US and China as setting the weather, but of course there are more other claimants, and Philippines is one potential wild card in that. Then there are the freedom of navigation operations themselves. We just had one earlier this week. The question is whether the United States will maintain its commitment to doing those freedom of navigation operations. So far it seems to be very much a cautious, incremental approach that's been followed. But to maintain the tempo of those operations, it will only become more difficult as other areas around those artificial islands eventually will have to be challenged. And that's more operationally risky for the United States, and certainly that's some area where we could see tensions begin to rise with China later in the year. Finally, North Korea, the predictable wild card. 2016 got off to a bang, literally, a nuclear form, in the form of the fourth nuclear test conducted by Pyongyang. And this is very much a very predictable challenge, as I said, but one in which there are no clear policy solutions, because the United States has tried dealing with North Korea. It's a very different proposition to dealing with Iran, because the train is very far out the station in terms of the nuclear capability that Pyongyang has already developed. And in fact, we have reports now that North Korea may be conducting a missile test within the next couple of weeks. If so, it's because they're not unpredictable or irrational, but in fact, have probably very cannily judged the dynamic between the United States and China does not allow a very punishing sanctions response. We've seen Mr. Kerry go to Beijing and return pretty much empty-handed. The Chinese have said that they will support some form of sanctions, but it seems to be at the moment more of the slap on the wrist variety than anything heavier than that. That will be obviously an ongoing challenge for the remainder of this year. North Korea is determined to make sure that it's not forgotten.
Well, that's a brilliant survey. Let me ask a couple of further questions of my colleagues, and then I'm going to, in 5 or 10 minutes, give everybody here an opportunity to ask a question. So put your thinking caps on and start to formulate some tough questions. Let me ask you each about the US presidential race. I think it's not controversial to say this is the screwiest race in decades. It's amazing that a country of America's weight and seriousness carries on like this every 4 years. The contests on both sides are actually still remarkably uncertain. On the Republican side, we really have no idea what will happen. We'll get the first actual piece of data in relation to both the Republican and Democratic races in a couple of hours, actually, from Iowa. Not that I don't think probably those results will be determinative in any way. So it's really an open race on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, it's much more open than we would think. And with a self-declared socialist from the northeast of the United States taking quite a bit of skin off Secretary Clinton's shins. I hate to think what Senator Elizabeth Warren is thinking now about her decision not to run for president, because if somebody like Bernie Sanders could be scoring the way he is in the polls, imagine if another liberal woman were running against Hillary. Nevertheless, I've said for a long time that that I think Hillary will probably win this election. I think she's still quite likely to become the next president of the United States. People always talk about Hillary Clinton's weaknesses, but I think any other candidate in the race would love to be as weak as Hillary Clinton is this year. Whomever is elected, I think we're probably, with the exception perhaps of Bernie, as long as we don't feel the burn, I think the world will probably feel a different kind of US foreign policy from the next president. There is a sense in which US foreign policy operates like a pendulum, and we swing from overly cautious to overly assertive foreign policy. And I think there's such a general sense in the polity in America and even in the foreign policy community, apart from real wonks, that America has taken too much of a step back, and we'll probably see the next president draw a distinction between him or herself and President Obama by stepping in to some of these conflicts that America has held back from. But of course, who exactly is elected and what kind of intellectual frame they bring to the race, if that's not too kind a phrase to use about some of the candidates, the kind of issues that they're passionate about will have big implications for the rest of us, because even small differences at the centre of the global system can have big reverberations as you get further out. And on that topic, let me ask, perhaps I'll go in reverse order. Let me start with you, and if you can just give me a brief comment, each of you, on how you think the results in the presidential race this year will play out in terms of Asian security, in terms of the Pacific, and in terms of the Middle East. Ewan.
Well, we've already seen foreign policy in China featuring more prominently in an earlier stage of the campaign than historically been the case. I think that's only going to intensify, and that will obviously politicize relationships across Asia. If there's a signature policy that unites US approach under Obama, it's supposed to be the so-called rebalance or pivot. The fact that we don't know precisely what to call it, I think, tells its own story. It has been, I think, a mixed record, but whether the legacy will be taken forward by Mrs. Clinton, if she prevails, she, of course, was personally associated with it, the strongest in her capacity as the Secretary of State. I think we can assume that Asia is not going to disappear from the radar, whoever is in the White House next year. But if it's Mrs. Clinton, obviously the greatest chance for continuity in that rebalance will be observed. The wild card would be, I think, felt between now and then, even before the results are out. I've talked about North Korea. North Korea has a habit of waiting till the last moment to try and get a deal. They did it under Bill Clinton, and they waited too late. They almost got a missile deal. They waited till the 11th hour, and the negotiations just ran out of time. They haven't necessarily learned that mistake. And it may be that this posturing in terms of nuclear tests, missile tests, that one element of it is to try and strong-arm the US back to the table while it still can. I think that would be a misjudgment. but it's certainly something that could also complicate U.S. relations in Northeast Asia. In terms of Australian-U.S. relations, well, the luck of doing this event in early February rather than 2 weeks ago is that we don't have to forecast Mr. Turnbull's visit to Washington. We know how it went, which was rather successful. Although I think, as I wrote for the Interpreter just last week, I think we have a slight danger of focusing too much on the man, and that the dynamics within the alliance, particularly in how U.S.-China tensions play out in that election year, may be too strong, I think, for however canny a leader is in Canberra to be able to manage. That's certainly a risk that's going to come across the water, I think. I think in terms of the South China Sea, we have seen the US is trying to hold the line, but also internally divided. We've had Admiral Harris, the very outspoken chief of PACOM, talking about how he wants to do more complex, more frequent freedom of navigation of operations. We have seen now the second operation after the Lassen, after a period of several months, but not as frequent as was originally promised. We heard about twice per quarter, and several times we've heard the talk and the action hasn't been delivered. So I think maintaining credibility in that sort of handover period is also going to be a delicate dance for the United States, particularly as China has a habit of trying to push and test U.S. resolve.
Terrific. Jenny, how does the Pacific figure in the deliberations of the presidential candidates?
Fairly easy question for me to answer because Pacific doesn't get much US attention at all. In fact, the US is most noted in the region for its absence. And as is familiar to most of you, of course, ceding ground to other players which have expressed a lot more interest in the region in recent years, notably China, of course. Where I think there will be an impact, actually one thing that US has done of late has been a very negative thing and pulled out of a tuna treaty that it has with the region, which may have gone unnoticed for most of you, but it's going to have some pretty serious economic effects on smaller countries which are dependent on fisheries. So the one thing I have to judge is a very negative development so far. In terms of the results, I think if Michael is right and Mrs. Clinton is the successful Democratic candidate, then I think that's good news for the Pacific. Hillary visited Papua New Guinea while she was Secretary of State. She also went to the Cook Islands for the Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting. Then she's on the record as being suspicious of Chinese influence and trying to do more with the limited resources the US has in the Pacific to increase their relevance and their importance to the region. So I think that all was well. Her inclination to be very supportive of USAID and promote the role of women, I think, is important. So I think Hillary will be good news for the region if she eventually wins. On the other side, if the Republicans are successful, they also have a record of being very concerned about rising Chinese influence in the region. I think, and as we've seen through the campaign, as Ewan mentioned, the fact that they are candidates are clearly prioritising that competition aspect. I think they might look to the Pacific as a region where they can have a few wins and sort of demonstrate to China that they're not going to sort of tolerate this impeachment, I guess, of their power in the region.
Anthony, the Middle East, the vexed question of the US role in the Middle East, where President Obama has spent a lot of his presidency getting out of wars in the Middle East. Do you think the next president will get back into the war game?
Well, I mean, certainly the region will be watching the presidential election probably more so than previous elections, and that relates both to America's adversary in the region but also its allies. Certainly the consensus perception in the region is that somehow America is pulling back under Obama. I don't think that's right, but I think certainly the terms of American engagement with the region have changed. It is much less heavily military and much more focused on diplomacy. So there was also, particularly I think amongst American allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia, an increasing exasperation with US policy, not just as a result of this perception that the US is pulling back, but that the US wasn't supporting its allies. So I think President Trump will face some very heavy expectations from allies in the region. And for me, that is the real question here. You know, there's been a lot of loose rhetoric flying around the presidential campaign so far. Lots of criticism of President Obama. But I think what President Obama, to give him some credit, is dealing with are the harsh realities about the limits of US power and the limits of US resources. And I don't think, the next US president is suddenly going to be able to conjure up new resources new magical abilities to deal with some really deep problems that the region has. So I think despite all the talk of America winning again, I don't see, beyond some superficial changes, any really significant shifts in US policy in the region, because I don't think there's much room for them to go somewhere else.
All right. Let's press pause on the conversation up here and take some questions from the audience. So the old principles apply. Please wait until one of my colleagues brings you a microphone. Please indicate your name and any affiliation that you might want to mention before you ask a very brief question rather than making a long statement. Sir, I saw your hand first. Just down the front, Alistair, thank you.
John Dobies, no affiliations, just happily retired. But why submarines? Why not fighter jets? Why not aircraft carrier?
They're both expensive. I mean, submarines don't exist in isolation in that regard. But in terms of, the politics are very different, as I'm sure you're aware. The reliance of the coalition on South Australia and the fact that it's made that beholden to having a domestic build as a prerequisite for all three bidders, I think, clearly puts it into different political territory. But in terms of the project too, it's often compared to Space Shuttle in terms of its difficulty level. Whereas the luxury of the F-35, it may cost more than its weight in gold, but it's still produced predominantly overseas. I mean, Australia does have a share in that production, but the risk is spread in a way that with two partners operating on a submarine, it's not. And this is also an untested design. The Collins had its problems, perhaps which have been overemphasized. I mean, it's still an effective submarine, but it's taken a long time to get it to that comfort level that it's in now. And the problem is that decision can't be delayed too much longer, because the lifespan of the Collins is also a clock that's ticking on the future submarine. Therefore, it's not something that Australia has the luxury of waiting for. In strategic terms, if we're looking at deterrence as an important part of conventional deterrence of what Australia needs in the future, the submarine probably goes further than any other platform to providing that as an autonomous unit, in the way that even aircraft are fundamentally much more dependent on air-to-air refueling and the whole communication suite that comes with that. So they can only operate a certain distance from the mainland. Whereas submarines, that's been their main comparative advantage since they were invented, is that they run silent, they run deep. And until technology can actually crack detection in a really fundamental way, I think that will continue to give them that strategic edge. And that's why Australia is prepared to pay the very large sums of money that it is in seeking a replacement.
Excellent. Yes, the gentleman at the back.
Thank you. If I might go back to the Middle East for a second. The Obama-Netanyahu relationship has been notoriously strained, and I was wondering what you saw as the prospect of a realignment of the relationship between the US and Israel, and where the Israel-Palestinian conflict might fit into some prospect.
Yes.
Sorry, it's Yuri Vint from Plus 61J. Anna.
Look, no question the US-Israel relationship has been under strain. And it's really, it's not the US-Israel relationship, it's the relationship between the Netanyahu administration and the Obama administration, and particularly personally between them. And that's had consequences for the relationship. It's had consequences for how they manage disagreements. Although it should be said that there are large parts of the relationship in terms of military and intelligence cooperation that go on pretty much undisturbed. I think a lot is going to depend on what the situation is on the ground when the new president takes office. Now, a lot will also depend on who the president is. If it's a President Trump versus a President Clinton, there will obviously be some differences there. But I don't, you know, I think that in both cases, you'll probably see an effort to kind of set a new page for the relationship, to kind of push past the disagreements between Obama and Netanyahu. But whether they can actually do that will depend on what's happening on the ground. What's the state of the relationship with the Palestinians? And, you know, one of the things that I didn't mention is, in my kind of three things to watch is, I think, unfortunately, we probably will see an increase in tension between Israelis and Palestinians over the coming year. It's often been said that that kind of conflict has been pushed to the side by, you know, the bigger things happening in the region. I think it's likely, given the complete absence of any process of discussion or negotiation or talks between, contacts between the two sides, we're more likely to see a gradual, or in some, maybe even a less gradual escalation in that crisis. And that then will put some pressure on US-Israeli relations. So I think, as I said, the first, you know, the instinct of both, whether it's Clinton or whether it's Republican, will be to try and, you know, okay, let's turn a new page, let's reset the relationship. But whether they can actually do that will depend on what happens on the ground, particularly on the Palestinian front.
As you know, there's been this controversy stirred up by Mr. Trump recently about whether Ted Cruz is qualified to run for president. And I think Ted Cruz's mother, from memory, is Canadian. And I noticed someone on Twitter yesterday said, if he's eligible to run for president, well, Bibi's mother, I think, was American, so perhaps Bibi could run for president of the United States. And as Anthony said to me, that idea probably appeals to Bibi at some level. Alex Oliver.
Jenny, I wanted to ask you a question, actually. Aid is obviously high on the agenda this year, as in last year, with all the aid budget cuts, and with Papua New Guinea being our largest aid recipient. I'm going to be playing devil's advocate here. Do you see that Australia's position is compromised at all by the obligations with the Manus Island Centre in terms of whether we get sufficient leverage with the Papua New Guinean government in order to administer those aid disbursements properly?
Thanks, Alex. My favourite question. clearly, there's an impact. The deal that was done between Prime Minister Rudd, everyone can remember that long ago, and Prime Minister O'Neill to set up the detention centre in Manus was a quid pro quo. We had to deliver big additional aid projects that were to be actually quarantined from the aid program. They've since been wound into the aid program, but they are treated a little bit differently. They are meant to be sort of cooperative projects between Papua New Guinea and Australia, where PNG puts in a certain amount of money and expertise as well to those projects. So I think, you know, the fact that O'Neill believed he got a very good deal out of that and basically asserted to Australia that he has the say over where aid is spent now. He will determine what their priorities are. And so the power shifts to the PNG side, where it's less room for flexibility on the Australian side to say, well, actually, we think your problems are over here rather than here. So aid becomes a lot more political than it was in the past, so certainly it has an impact. But I would like to think that there's still some... Still a good level of discussion across both levels, and that everything is not subject to the whim of the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea. And indeed, the aid program is so large that can't happen. As you said, Papua New Guinea is our largest aid recipient, I think in excess of $500 million now per annum. So there's no way that one person can control all of that. So there's still a lot of good work going on there, but definitely it is more difficult for those decisions to be made quickly and for aid to be directed where it's needed, perhaps in times of crisis than it was before.
Thank you. Did I see a question down here at the front?
My name is Marford Analyst from the Philippine Consulate General in Sydney. My question is for Dr. Graham, and you made mention of freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea, as well as the Philippine case before the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea. Given these two factors, for 2016, do you think we will see a change in China's actions as far as the in maritime actions as far as the South China Sea is concerned?
No, I don't think we see any significant shift of direction from China ahead. I mean, there is a wild card factor in terms of what's happening with the Chinese economy and the impact that that will have on foreign policy, whether that actually encourages a more adventurous policy on the part of Xi Jinping is an open question. But my take is that these two external influences on China's policy, A, of the U.S. presidential cycle, coming to the end of a second term in which we've got an outgoing administration, and also the PCA decision awaited, are two very good reasons, I think, for China to want to change the facts on the ground as far as it can. And actually, we often ascribe long-term motivations to China, but we've seen actually increasingly a sort of short-term get-the-job-done approach in terms of how quickly those constructions have proceeded. Now we have three clear military-grade length runways in Mischief Reef and two other features in the Spratlys. That's gone very, very fast indeed. And my hunch is that China probably will start the process of shifting defense forces at a slow incremental scale within the next 6 months. Obviously, it will depend on partly how it reacts to how the other claimants are providing excuses for China to fill out that template. And I think it is a template from which so much has been invested. The sheer cost involved in setting up those artificial lines, I think, itself speaks volumes for China's strategic ambitions in the South China Sea. However, I don't think that China is in a mobile force. I think that's partly gets back to the point of freedom of navigation operations, is that to make the point non-provocatively, not to seek an armed conflict, not to seek confrontations on the sea, but nonetheless to be present in a way, and this applies to Australia as it does to the United States, to make the point that heavyweight powers can't simply move around and use force and coercion to get their way. And I think that's an important principle.
Thank you. Tim Ford. Tim Ford here in the second row. Thank you, Alistair.
My name is Tim Ford, a retired peacekeeper. Nobody's mentioned the United Nations or the fact, of course, that we will have a new Secretary General, possibly a woman and possibly from Eastern Europe during the year. Do any of the panel wish to comment on the role the United Nations might play under over the next year in, on the, as a supporter to international peace and security?
Sure, I'll have a go. I mean, we're getting towards really towards the end of Ban Ki-moon's term as Secretary General. And I think most most people who observe the United Nations who are not employed by it would say that it's been a reasonably disappointing tenure. And so I think people are looking forward to the next Secretary General. There are lots of different candidates. There's a very live debate in Australia about two Antipodean candidates for Secretary General, which I notice has been caught up in some sort of internecine conflict within the government party room at the same time. A lot of the press that I've seen, as you say, Tim, has referred to the fact that there is a sentiment for a female Secretary General and that a general view that it's Eastern Europeans' turn. And I think those factors are both correct. But there are two other factors that people close to the process always remind me of that don't get a lot of mention in the Australian press. And that is that effectively the five permanent members of the Security Council effectively have a veto over the selection of the Secretary General. And Russia and China are probably unlikely to want a Westerner. They are probably unlikely to want someone who's a paid-up member, if you like, of the Western alliance. I mean, it's not an absolute thing, but Russia and China will be squinting their eyes and saying, do we want someone who is from a Five Eyes country? Do we want someone from a country, a national of a country that is a US ally? I think that will be a factor for Russia and China. It doesn't necessarily rule out Mr. Rudd or Ms. Clark, but it's a factor. And the other fourth factor that doesn't get a lot of mention in the press is that generally the P5, especially after the Kofi Annan period, seem to prefer a relatively docile candidate. I mean, effectively, one of the advantages that Ban Ki-moon had was that he would seem to be somebody of relatively modest ambitions, and so it's turned out to be. And the P5 really regard themselves, as you know, as really running the UN. I mean, they run the Security Council element of the UN. And in a sense, do they want a former head of government, somebody who has run a country, someone who is a big personality, do they want someone in that role? I think there are question marks over that because it's just unpredictable how somebody like that will operate. I think they'd probably instinctively be more amenable to someone who's a former diplomat or a former civil servant or an official who can probably be managed more easily. So I think those two factors have to be considered with the former two, and both of them probably make it tough either for Mr. Rudd or Ms. Clark. Of course, you can't rule either of them out. They're both resilient politicians who've achieved a lot of success in their life, but it will probably be tough for both of them. Probably our last question will go to Sarah Davidson.
I'm Sarah Davidson, Government Affairs Leader at Chartered Accountants Australia New Zealand. A question really for all of the panel. It's an election year in Australia, so I was just interested in any early thoughts you might have on policy recommendations for the government, particularly for Australia's Foreign Minister, that might help address some of the major issues you've identified for the coming year.
That's a great question, Sarah, because I was going to go to the Australian election last, so well done. And I might broaden the question out a bit to each of my colleagues, starting with Anthony. Policy recommendations are welcome, but also any thoughts on a signal difference between Mr. Abbott and Mr. Turnbull in your part of the world, or indeed between Mr. Turnbull and the current government and Mr. Shorten and the Labor Party on the other side?
I think undoubtedly we do see a difference between Mr. Turnbull and Mr. Abbott with respect to the Middle East and with respect particularly to Australia's commitment to coalition operations in Iraq and Syria. Mostly for the moment, it hasn't resulted in any material change of that commitment, although we recently saw Australia knock back a request for an additional commitment. And I think that the decision to knock that commitment back reflects a fundamental philosophical difference between Abbott and Turnbull in terms of the way they view both our commitment in Iraq and Syria, but also the threat posed by Islamic State. Now, I think both of them see it as a threat. Both of them see terrorism as a problem. But I think for Mr. Abbott, it was much more civilizational. It was much more ideological. We were there fighting the good fight. And that meant that there was a tendency on the former Prime Minister's part to kind of big up our commitment there and perhaps to go beyond what even Australian defence officials were comfortable with or were capable of providing. Whereas I think for Mr. Turnbull, he sees it as a very important security issue, but one that needs to be seen in a broader context, both in terms of how you deal with terrorism domestically, but also in terms of Australia's commitment to those operations. So he won't want to, you know, it's not going to dramatically decline, but you might see some gradual decline in our commitment over time, and I don't think you'll probably see any increase under Turnbull.
Jenny?
I think Australian policy in the region benefits from having the foreign minister play such a strong role in leadership rather than the prime minister, and I think we've seen benefits of that with Julie Bishop's close personal attention to a number of our key relationships over the time that she's been foreign minister. So I think, assuming that continues, and I think the difference possibly between her role in the Abbott government, her role in the Turnbull government, is that she has more, I guess, more the trust of the Prime Minister, and is given her lead in the region. So I think that's a positive thing, and we can see some evidence of that from the last government, where other members of the Abbott cabinet decided to drastically cut the aid program, and she was able to salvage at least aid for the Pacific. So we know where her priorities lie. And I think, you know, assuming that she continues to be the foreign minister, I think we'll see that priority continue. Where the Australian government needs to do a lot more work is on climate change response in the region. We finally sort of came together on targets in Paris, but there's a lot still to be done on climate change funding in the region. The announcements that were made in Paris were less than generous, and if we're serious about leading the region and showing the region that we are as seriously committed to addressing their problems, then a lot more needs to happen on climate change action.
Ewan?
One thing that appears to mark Mr. Turnbull apart from Mr. Abbott is a different philosophy on the use of the military and the use of military both as a tool and a policy tool as well and a political tool. I think we see just general, my sense is more caution about willingness to use the ADF. Whether that will also translate into a reduced willingness to fund defence, I think, is one key question that faces the next administration going forward. But perhaps these elections matter less than they would do normally, because from the moment from the polling, it suggests it's certainly Mr. Turnbull's to lose. I think my recommendation would be to recognise the importance of continuity in key positions like Julie Bishop. The fact that she has been a point of continuity, I think, has been a saving grace of the transition, which from outside Australia looks deeply puzzling, that election cycles are fairly short, and to have this many changes in top leadership and the ministerial reshuffles that flow from that, I think has been disruptive to the partnerships that Australia has formed in Asia. And I think that keeping the top people in the defence and foreign portfolios, I think, is a good signal of reassurance to make sure that those Asian relationships, which Mr. Turnbull is likely to prioritise, are kept sweet, I think, beyond the election.
I mean, the one element that my colleagues didn't mention, so perhaps I'll say something, is the opposition side of things. Obviously, Mr. Shorten's been pretty focused on domestic issues and trying to stay competitive. He gave a major speech to the Lowy Institute towards the end of last year on climate change, at which he announced very ambitious targets for Australia. He travelled around the Pacific, which is something that was quite unusual, with Tanya Plibersek, his shadow minister, and one or two other front benchers, and I've visited, I think, 3 to 4 Pacific countries, which is something we haven't seen for a long time. Tanya Plibersek, I think, has done a good job in a difficult role, given that she's shadowing the minister who's probably seen as the most successful minister, at least in the Abbott government, Julie Bishop. I think Tanya Plibersek has done a good job of getting across the brief. I think she's speaking to the National Press Club in the next couple of weeks, so it'll be worth tuning into that. And also, I think, to watching Mr. Turnbull's comments in the next few months too. I think we learned something from the remarks he made at CSIS and the comments he made with the President and so on, but those comments were very focused on the United States. And there's still a bit of a proxy war you'll see in the columns of our daily newspapers over the soul of Mr. Turnbull, with some saying that he's very orthodox pro-American foreign policy maker, and others saying that he's got a very different view on some of those big questions. So I think watching Mr. Turnbull's comments will be very interesting too. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take that opportunity to wrap things up, because at 1 Bligh Street, like at 31 Bligh Street, we'll always try to finish on time. Thank you, everybody, for coming to this first event. It's fantastic to have a full house at our first event here. We really appreciate your support. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank my colleagues, Steph, Suyin, Tara, Andrea, and others who've worked very hard to get this space ready. We'll continue to perfect this space and the event spaces at the Institute to make them as welcoming and friendly to all of you as possible. Let me also mention, for those of you who are not working at the Institute, that we're very sorry that this year we're going to lose one of our superstars at the Institute, somebody who's been with us for 8 years, Jenny Hayward-Jones. Jenny has run our Melanesia program for 8 years and, as I said, has been a very important contributor to the national debate on these questions. Jenny's decided to relocate to Britain with her family, so she's going from Port Moresby to rural Devon, which will be quite an interesting move. I'm delighted that Jenny has agreed to retain her affiliation with the Institute as a non-resident fellow, so she'll be doing some long-distance work with her. She's with us for another couple of months, so you'll see lots of products and research products over the course of the year. But I did want to mention today that we're very sorry to be losing Jenny. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us. We look forward to seeing you at the next event. The next event is actually this Friday. We have a very interesting event on Russia's Asian rebalance. Russia has sought to rebalance towards Asia in a way to match and head off the US rebalance. There are still a few tickets available for that event, so if you're interested, please speak with the Institute staff before you leave. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us.